Welcome to Lickin' On Leadership.
The purpose of this program is to bring to you interviews with industry leaders.
A weekly podcast bringing you leaders of the real estate and mortgage industry.
And I can't think of anyone better to join me in this role of providing this co-hosting role than one of the top leaders in our industry, and that's Mark Jones of AmeriFirst Mortgage Banking Group.
And here's the host of Lickin' On Leadership, David Lickin and Mark Jones.
I am excited to have joining me a legend in the industry, S.A. Ibram, who has been a legend in the industry, still is, and he's doing some exciting things. It's an honor to catch up with him here at the conference, at the social media Create Wow conference. S.A., so good to have you here.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'll excuse you exaggerating my being, you know, more than I was, but I've indeed been very fortunate in being in this industry for a long time and working with terrific people and making friends with all the amazing people who make up this industry.
Well, it is an amazing industry, and there's wonderful people that make it up. And you have been playing a significant role. Let's get in a little bit about your background so our listeners can get to know who you are and understand a little bit about the many companies that you have run and been at the foundation of. So you started in the industry how many years ago?
So I started I first worked for outside the financial services industry, but approximately 40 years ago, I came into the financial services industry, but in the consumer lending operations and finance side.
And so what drew you, what brought you into it? Was it a purpose decision or was it a light mind? You kind of by accident fell into it.
What brought me into it was falling in love with San Francisco.
Ah, so you started in San Francisco.
So I fell in love with San Francisco and I happened to be in San Francisco and behold, I'd gotten a call from a search firm asking me to, if I was interested in a job in Bank of America, which I wasn't sure, but having come to San Francisco, I said, of course, because this will allow me to move to San Francisco. And I'd been with GE in Cleveland, Ohio, in the lamp business before that.
Oh, really?
So I moved from Cleveland, Ohio to San Francisco.
But your background, your education is law, is that correct?
No, my education is engineering from India.
Oh, engineering from India, that's
and
right.
And then finance
that's right.
from the Wharton School.
I was thinking of Teresa when she was talking earlier today. It was Teresa has the law degree. But so yours is engineering. So when you make a transition from engineering to finance, is that just a real leap or is it because of the math and engineering that made it possible for you to function real well here?
So After engineering, I got my graduate degree in finance.
And, oh, you did?
At the Wharton School, which was at that time a very quantitative school, seemed like a natural place to go after engineering. And there were a fair number of, you know, people with undergrad degrees like mine, technical undergrad degrees, who went into finance. Then I made my way into leadership roles, but I spent the early years of my career in operations and risk management and credit scoring and modeling and so on.
So Wharton, I have to bring up Jack Guttentag, my good buddy, Professor Jack. Was he teaching economics there while you were there?
Yes, and he still is very active. And when I was at Radian, he'd call me every few months with a new idea about, doing mortgage insurance differently. And,
I know, he's still such
and
a
of course, you know, you can't do mortgage insurance differently unless Fannie and Freddie are willing to
Yeah,
let you do it, as the counterparties on the other side.
He is such a good friend, and I've had him on this podcast numerous times. And I just value his mind and how he thinks. Just such a good guy, but always looking at how to improve the industry, which is always refreshing.
His mind never ages.
It doesn't. Well, I met him in Madrid, speaking in Madrid, Spain. We were speaking at the top 10 ministers of finance. We were at a meeting, and he and I were both the keynote speakers in at that conference. And he walked up to me at 85. He says, "I'm thinking about starting a business." I said, "How old are you?" And he says, "85." I said, "You're starting a business?" He said, "Yes." I said, How long do you plan to live?" He says, "At least 5 more years." I said, "How's that?" He says, "I have a 5-year business plan." So he's just that kind of guy, very driven sort of guy. But let's get back talking about your career and your background. So what is it about the mortgage industry? Why was this such a good place for you?
So I was in my early 30s, and Chemical Bank in New York was growing its consumer business. And Chemical Bank, like most New York banks, had a very strong risk culture. And they didn't have anybody who had come up the traditional side of chemical who had an understanding of consumer lending. So at age 30-something, in my early 30s, I was made the chief risk officer for the consumer bank at Chemical Bank. And on the risk, on the credit committee of the bank, I had like a $1.1 billion authority. Not that as a consumer, you know, you could ever make a consumer loan for $1.1 billion. But that's how I got into the risk management side. And then Chemical's mortgage business had followed Citi's no income, no asset model and started.
What years were that now we're talking about?
We're talking about the 80s, you know, the mid 80s or late 80s. And the defaults in the mortgage business started going up. And I was the one who had been advocating tighter underwriting and, you know, doing things more thoughtfully. And I had shown when I was chief risk officer for the credit card business at Chemical that I could equally be sensitive to marketing issues because, you know, one of the things, unlike other risk managers, I did was I said, one of the best ways to manage the profile of your risk business is to bring in a lot of good borrowers to offset any bad borrowers you have. So, you know, it was music to the marketing guys. And they said, oh, you want us to go and sell more? I said, as long as they're good risk people, you know, they represent good risk. So I was given the opportunity to run the mortgage business and make it move away from the risk side, you know, the risk excess that it had gotten into. And I had terrific people working for me who later on Chemical became part of Chase Mortgage.
That's right.
And these are the people who became the leadership team for the Chase Mortgage business.
David Matthews and I are very close friends. He speaks so highly of you. He loved the leadership that you had there. And so he was at Chemical. I think that's where your paths came.
He was in an acquisition we made while at Chemical and a tremendous, tremendous guy. You know, you often run into people on the technology side who live in silos. The advantage with Dave was he was not only good at technology, but he understood the connection between business and technology. So he was a technology person who focused on solving business problems rather than creating technology for its own sake, and he had no ego in that process. And on top of that, he was a fantastic person.
Yeah, a great person. Oh, yeah, I love him.
And still is.
And still is. Yeah, we're still close friends. We get together every time I'm up in Chicago or in Michigan, wherever he's at. We connect.
And he's a Renaissance person. He went into the restaurant.
I know. And then he went in, and then he went over and ran the Restaurant Association afterwards. So it's amazing how many of us have made some different transitions. But you've stayed for the most of your career after you made the transition to mortgage banking. You stayed in mortgage banking. Is that an accurate statement?
That's
until
true.
You retired.
Then that's true because with a brief spell in international reengineering, running international reengineering for American Express, and then my wife got tired of me traveling around the world all the time.
Yeah.
And
they can get tired of that.
And
that's a good sign.
Actually,
a good thing that she wanted you home.
And the senior person who had been the president of Chemical Bank had moved over to run Greenpoint Bank. And my wife was the one who engineered me joining Greenpoint because she didn't want me to travel.
That's
and at
right.
that time, they were only in Queens and Manhattan.
So talk about from going there to Greenpoint, because, again, I connected with you with David. He and I were working at UltraPrize together at the time, and we went out, and it was over by Sausalito, not too far from where we're at, that you had Greenpoint. Is that correct?
So when I joined Greenpoint, we didn't have any California presence other than branches. And we had just acquired, before I joined, the Barclays mortgage business in Charlotte. And Greenpoint had its very old and very well-managed but conservative and relatively small 100-plus-year-old mortgage business, which catered uniquely to the immigrants in New York. My boss, who had come from Chemical, was looking for, Tom Johnson, was looking for a business to acquire. And I came in as head of risk management and helped him find a business, and we found Headlands.
Okay.
And when we acquired Headlands, the board told me to move out to combine the businesses, run it, and we chose to run that out of California, and I moved to Marin County to Larkspur, which is
Larkspur,
not too far
that's
from.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. And we soon outgrew that space because we were growing so fast, and we moved to much larger building in the Watto, and we outgrow that and reclaimed our Larkspur space in addition to that.
One of the things that is hallmark about your career is how you have identified and found top executives to work for you and then empowered them and then helped create a lot of wealth for them. Tell them about what is your key to that, looking for key executives. A lot of people struggle with that one, S.A.
So tongue-in-cheek, they say that some of the most effective leaders and CEOs are people who are inherently lazy or distracted because they want to have people under them who can do all the heavy lifting. And, well, you know, neither here nor that, because, you know, you can't be lazy in this industry.
No, you
got to work very hard. But
you were, that was your attempt for modesty. That was good. That was a good try.
But serious, Wayne, I, you know, grew up in a home in India where my mother pulled me in an academic direction, my dad in a people management direction, and I valued both of those traits. So, and I felt that if you had a handful of very smart and capable people working for you, and if you helped them, many people put up these barriers and limits in terms of what they think they can achieve, and you know they're
so
capable of a lot more.
A lot more.
And I sometimes inherited those people, sometimes I recruited them. So in the Greenpoint case, I inherited Steve Abreu from the Headlands acquisition, and I saw in him, in fact, I remember when we were still doing due diligence on Headlands, taking him out to lunch. I said, Steve, I've had a chance to observe you the last 2-3 days, and if Greenpoint makes this acquisition, let me tell you, you are going to be one of the reasons that I have the confidence to recommend making this acquisition. And Steve
lit up.
And I made a phenomenal
team. Oh, you guys are amazing.
Very few people as smart as him, as knowledgeable as him. When I went to Greenpoint, I'd met Teresa in industry meetings. She and I were on the MBA Board of Governors together, and we were on a couple of other industry leadership forums. And I made a mental note that as soon as I get a chance, I'm going to hire her.
You're going to hire her? And you had her at Radiant?
I did.
And you had her at Greenpoint?
I went to Radiant, sorry.
Yeah,
when I went to Radiant,
yeah.
I recruited her. And she, again, was somebody who turned out to be a phenomenal person. And, you know, she was typecast as a lawyer, but she was a lot more than a lawyer. Nothing wrong with being a lawyer. You sometimes see the whole picture in the mortgage business as a lawyer. And I moved her to be head of risk management. And I promoted her to be president of the mortgage insurance business, which was the flagship business. And she did an absolutely phenomenal job working side by side with me and the rest of the team in getting us out of the downturn and then expanding our business and putting Radiant on the map.
Well, it was.
But she contributed to everything that we had to do in terms of heavy lifting as well as...
So let's talk about the attributes of a successful leader, because that's a lot of what you have been and you have identified in others. What are the key attributes? Is it being the smartest? Is it being the hardest worker? Is it being able to relate to people? What are the factors that you would identify?
See, in our business, you have to have some smarts and industry knowledge, because this is a very complicated business. You can make mistakes by originating the wrong loans or not having a clearly thought out strategy that leverages operations capabilities, people capabilities, strong balance sheet, technology, and all the things that you have to manage to make the business work. But along with that, equally important is people skills, because ultimately you could be the smartest person and have the best design strategy, but you can't implement it yourself.
Yeah.
You're going to have to implement it through other people.
So let's talk about implementing through other people. How did you bring that about? Is it how much perspiration versus inspiration goes into that formula?
I had the chance to observe my dad in action in a small business when I was growing up. And then really, there was one event, now that you remind me, I just remembered, that happened to me while I was with Chemical Bank. So I was put in charge of marketing consumer loans. So I was in charge of managing the marketing for all consumer loans other than mortgages at that time. And I came up with this new idea for a product, having come from the credit card business. And I said, if somebody qualifies for $25,000 in unsecured credit card, I'm going to give them a second or third mortgage, whatever it is, and file a lien against their property. And it's up to them to determine whether that interest was tax deductible or not, at a time when tax deductibility was limited to only home secured loans. And that product took off.
Okay. And very innovative. That was.
But I stepped on the toes of people who were in product management. And so these people, because I was this analytical nerd who was not sensitive to people and I should have paid them a lot more attention before, legitimately got upset. And they did not. I needed their cooperation to make the product successful. And, of course, they weren't willing to cooperate. And I happened to be with my boss's boss, who was the vice chairman of the bank at that time. And he told us that if anybody gets in your way, let me know and I will call and,
make sure that
you don't pack a wig on them to put them in place. So I went to bed thinking the next day I was going to tell them, these are the four people you need to tell to cooperate with me. And I don't know what happened to me that night. I woke up in the morning, and instead of telling them to whip them into place, I said, these four people came up with this brilliant idea. and you know, and this idea is going to make a lot of money for the company, and I'd love for you to call them and congratulate them on this great idea and tell them I told you about it and how they were going to create it. So it wasn't really the idea, but once they got stroked for that, they ran with it. And I realized then that it's all about people. If you deliberately created people who are going to block you and not going to succeed, but if you create...
When you help, yes, yeah. When you're helping lift other people up, and I think, you know, people say, you know, people are like elevators. They're either lifting you up or you're bringing you down. And I think that is a good example of you lifting up those that were probably in your way or not your fan at that time. What are some things that you would say that this created one of the biggest crises in my life in the working world, a business situation, and how did you overcome that?
I had many little crises on the way, but the biggest crisis was a year and a half after I went to Radian. We had just negotiated merger of equals with MGIC, which when I went in was a much larger company, but right. In the first year that I'd been there, our market cap caught up with them, and we announced it, and our stock hit an all-time high. And then the next week, HSBC announced the beginning of the subprime crisis, and I thought we were remote from it. And in the next few months, it started hitting us, and there I was, stock down to a dollar, less than a dollar.
Wow! From a high, what was from the high of what?
From a high of $60.
High of $60 down to less than a dollar.
Right, and our credit ratings over time diminishing, and our credit spreads widening, and everybody outside thinking we're not going to make it, and even people inside doubting whether we would make it. And some of my well-wishers and mentors in the industry, like my former bosses, calling me out of the blue and just wanting to talk. And I figured out afterwards they're trying to be sympathetic to me because they thought my company was going to disappear. And here I was, my first job as a public company CEO, been in it for a year and a half, and my company is going to go out of existence. So I never felt that was going to happen, though. But I had to convince people around me that wasn't going
to happen. So why did you not think it was? I mean, what was it, just an inner knowing, or did you have a plan? I mean, what caused you to have that conviction that you were going to make it?
First of all, I'm a sucker for challenges that people think are difficult to solve. So while I was at the Wharton School, there was this professor, Marshall Bloom, who was considered the strictest professor. He was a finance professor. And somebody bet me a dollar to do my graduate thesis with him. And I did. And very quantitative guy. And much as I had quantitative skills from India, I didn't have computer skills. In those days, computers were not as easy to use.
Right.
You had the old IBM COBOL thing, and you'd put cards in it. And luckily, I found a partner in my project who had come from having worked at IBM. And we each did our part, and we got the highest grade in that seminar. And what's more, I did an analysis on a company and got paid by them for doing this project.
Oh, really? That's even better.
But anyways, I always was a sucker for doing these kind of things. So I said, what's going to make us disappear? I said, it's not the stock price unless it goes to zero.
Right.
It's running out of liquidity, running out of customers, or having our employees give up and abandon us. So I said, liquidity, we'll find a way to manage. But if I can keep my customers and my employees with me, then I have a chance.
So let's go into that very point. What was your strategy to do just that?
So with respect to customers, I had, at Greenpoint, built a set of very, very strong customer relationships. And I used to project myself as the only MI mortgage insurance CEO who had been in the shoes of my customers. So I'd go and tell them my job is to not be in somebody who thinks their company is doing a favor to you by, you know, giving you mortgage insurance. My view is you are doing us a favor by giving us business.
Good.
And I always thank them, and I had great relationships with them, and perhaps they felt sorry for me to being in that situation. And then I brought in some people who'd been former MBA chairs as an advisory group to help advise me. And their biggest job was to help us anchor our customers in and to say good things about us to customers, how they should do business with us. And I convinced my board to put Teresa in the role of the mortgage, insurance CEO.
Yes.
And I said, we're lucky in this company. We've got four well-liked former chairs of the MBA helping us, and you've got Teresa and I two of the most liked people in the mortgage industry. So how can customers not do business with us? And we would go and thank them and we treat them.
So it was
their
appreciation.
Careful.
It was really that showing that appreciation. That speaks to the customer. How about the employees? Because there was a lot of there's a lot of employees. Some did leave.
Yes.
And but you held on to some top talent.
So, you know, when you have a major merger, which created a lot of uncertainty for the employees called off, creates a lot of uncertainty in the company. Now, it cuts both ways. I've always felt that in every problem lies an opportunity. So we had several people leave because they thought after the merger they wouldn't have a job because the company is going to move its headquarters from Philadelphia to Milwaukee, which is part of the condition Magic's board had put on our deal. And luckily, though, it was a smaller ship to turn around, so I had fewer employees to motivate.
Right.
And we went about basically, you know, one of the things I'd done when I first got to Radian was always walked around and built strong, strong personal relationships with every employee. In fact, there's this Philadelphia Inquirer article called CEO in the Mailroom, which is the story of my first day at Radian. I showed up, my non-exec board chair called at about 9:30 to see if I had gotten to the company, and nobody could find me. Finally, somebody said they saw me in the mailroom, and I had been in the there in the office from 7 o'clock, and at that time I was in the main room sitting with the mail people and opening envelopes and talking with them. And
I love that. So I remember that story coming out. It's great.
So everybody in the
Would you forward me a link? Because that story is still out there. You have a link to that story.
I don't know if the Philadelphia Inquirer has...
They've got
in the archives. And
yeah, someone has it. Someone forwarded it to me because they thought it was a great leadership story.
So the lesson I'd learned at Greenpoint was the power of connecting with people. So I'd already connected with them. I had a great relationship with them. And I said, look, the merger is off. You don't have to feel insecure about your jobs anymore. And I think we can beat it. And that was one thing. The second thing we did was because externally everybody said they're going out of business, I started growing our sales force. I told our sales guy at that time, before Teresa took over the mortgage insurance, I went directly to our head of sales in the mortgage insurance business and I said, go hire people and find new customers because all our peers are sitting on their hands and paralyzed.
So that psychologically, that was powerful.
Oh, it was very motivating for the employees because they said, how can we be going out of business when we're actually growing and expanding?
That's great.
And the third thing
was
all these little hooky things in building the employee morale. So Philadelphia has this very famous inner city mural program.
Yes.
And it's actually exported that to many, many other cities around the world. So I discovered that somebody working in the company for us was a weekend painter of those murals. And I told him, let's create a mural that'll uplift the morale of the people in the company. So he and I came up with this idea called Radiant Rising. And we came up with this mural where we said, employees, you can be in this mural, you can help paint it. And we created this huge mural about our employees standing there with their arms raised, looking to the future with houses in the background. And the theme was Radiant Rising. Imagine us rising when everybody's
brilliant.
Telling us we're not
going to
rise.
I remember that.
And that became an icon of the company.
Everybody
rallied. Even today, even after I leave, I think new employees, when they come to Philadelphia, get their picture taken in front of it. And we had the mayor come for the ribbon cutting, and these employees saw their own faces in there, and I was there in the background, not in the front, and Teresa was there, and our CFO was there, and we were all there with them imagining a better future. When you imagine success,
That is the truth. When you imagine it, when you can see it, it does come.
When you imagine failure, that's going to happen.
That's exactly right. So it's like when driving a car, where your eyes are looking is where your car is going to go or where you end up. I think it's so important. That's such a good thing that you did. I remember those days in the leadership. I didn't know you then as I do now. But I was so taken back and just stood in awe of the ideas that you came up with. I thought it was some of the best coaching and executive management we had seen in our industry at that point. So it was brilliant. I love what you did. You talked about how your dad inspired you. Talk about some of the people in your life that you say, I was really impacted by these people. Who would they be?
And of course, you always have your parents because my mom always pushed me to be as good academically as I could be and to go to the best schools and the most demanding schools. And later on, it was, what she instilled in me that allowed me to get into Wharton. But my dad was very different, and he was a people person. And he, would respect the most lowest employee in his business. And he would,
so good.
And in fact, he would, whenever I said, oh, that's just a lowly employee, he'd say, no, don't say that. He's just as important as anybody else.
That's so good. To have that instilled early, early on is so, so good and so inspiring to a whole organization.
So then the other thing was, when I first started my job, I worked with GE. And I went in there as this person.
What year was that? Approximately what year was that?
It was in 1978, and I was one of the few MBAs that GE hired. And at that time, the chairman of GE was on the Wharton Board of Overseers, Greg Jones. And when I had all these different offers and trying to decide which company go to, I asked the dean of the school, and he said, oh, go to Greg Jones's company. And I learned a lot in GE. So one of the most interesting things I worked is I went to this internal consulting organization. And those days, companies like GE did not fire people after they had peaked. And if you had been a senior person and for whatever reason, you were no longer running a major business, they put you as an advisor to the other businesses in the company. And I ended up working on a project for this guy, Lloyd Harriet, who had run the aerospace business at GE and who had run other businesses, and he'd been a very senior business in businesses that GE had phased out. And GE was a company at that time that manufactured some of the best managers and leaders in the industry. And I got the benefit of getting Lloyd's insights. And he told me, said, look, if you rely on analytics and tools, they're very important to help you make a decision. You will go in one path, and that's not a very bad path. But if you want to go the general manager route, which everybody in GE wanted to go to, you have to really learn how to deal with people.
That's so true.
And,
yeah.
And the company, GE, as well as this person, I think were very instrumental. And then over the years, I ended up with people who really took an interest in me, and they gave me a chance. It's very hard when you've been a staff, geeky staff person building models to get a chance to run a business. And yet I was given that opportunity, and whoever took that risk took a big risk. And you never find out what people are capable of until you give them a chance. And that,
that's right.
Through my whole career, allowed me to do things like taking Teresa and being a lawyer to a...
Yeah. And so let's talk about the ones where you gave them a chance and it didn't work out. What did you do in those cases? Were they just gone? But you have a legacy of really caring about the people, even the ones that struggled.
So, you know, companies have a huge investment in people.
Yes.
And unless they attitude-wise screw up totally or negatively, you really can find other uses for them. And their knowledge, you know, one of the things that Silicon Valley does very easily that other companies don't celebrate is sometimes failure can train people to be very objective if they're humble enough to learn from it.
That's the key.
And so if I felt this person was refusing to accept failure and they were being unrealistic, I couldn't have them infect other people and I had to get rid of them. Unfortunately, there are many people who are not going to go with the program and they think sometimes they're too smart and everybody else is wrong. But in many cases, these were salvaged and got a second chance and did other things. But also, people sometimes, we tried not to typecast people. So I've got this wonderful example of, we had a young woman who was our assistant controller, one of our three or four assistant controllers at Greenpoint in Novato, California. And she got married to this guy who happened to be in Las Vegas. And she said, I'm moving to Las Vegas. And we said, we don't want to lose you. She said, I'd love to still work for Greenpoint. Well, we only had a sales and operations branch there. So he said, you know numbers, and our business is selling brokers on the numbers and tools. Why don't you become a salesperson? She became one of our star salespeople.
Oh, really? That's amazing. That's a great story.
And I remember one time then we used to visit all these branches, and we'd ask people. We met with the sales team in the morning and the operations people in the afternoon, and at lunchtime I'd walk around. And we'd ask everybody, what can we do different? And I remember in the morning she said, you know this new product we launched last week? Some of the language in it and some of the software in it is confusing and difficult for customers to handle. And we broke for lunch, and I talked to the operations, and I happened to run into her that evening before we left for the airport. I said, oh, by the way, that thing you ran, I already talked to the IT people, and that's going to be fixed in 4 days. And later, I ran into her at our sales conference in a few months later, and she said, you know, let me tell you something that's true, and I hope you won't be annoyed. He said, no. She said, I was at that time seriously thinking about going to a much larger company because they're going to pay me twice as much as I was making at Greenpoint. But she said, how can I go there? But because I have a voice that is heard and acted upon by the CEO of the company.
See, that is so important. Feeling a sense of being heard. And not just heard, but it was acted on. So that
right. I always told them, you are the ones who drive the business, and my job is to help you drive it.
Yeah.
And we practice.
So how do you keep from getting in and doing their job? I mean, because I mean, you went in and fixed things where you could, but you also held clear lines of accountability. Talk about the accountability and that boundary, because I find there's two bosses that are really the hardliners, and then there's the ones that are, you know, I would say enabling weaker people or complacency.
So you know, you have the challenge of both failure and success. So the challenge of failure was, you know, you had somebody running a branch and they just couldn't deliver success in a very rewarding market, and you had competitive data that showed others were doing a good job, and you had to give them another chance, and then you say you couldn't do it. But we also had the same problem with success. Because sometimes people were doing brilliantly well with in a branch, and we found that we were getting a lot of business from half of the customers, and we weren't getting any business from other half of the customers.
Really?
And we said, you've reached your breadth of management, and we need to split your branch into two and get somebody else. And it was devastating for the branch manager. So we came up with this clever idea. We said, you nurture that person, and we'll give you a diminishing commission on that person's success. And then
that's
if
good.
You are great at nurturing a lot of these branches and a lot of branches spin off you, we'll make you a regional manager. So we had to come with ways of rewarding even success, because even success produced some of those challenges.
That's right.
Because
that's,
as you know, no matter who, whether it's a salesperson or a branch manager, their success comes from only a fraction of their customers.
You talked about Teresa being one of your success stories, and you point to her. What's another one on probably in a different vein, would you say, is this person stands out to me to this day?
I had mentioned Steve Abreu before.
Oh, you did?
And I can't say enough good things about both of these people. Steve was he was incredibly loyal. He was very smart. He knew how all the pieces of the mortgage business were glued together. And he and I learned a lot from each other. And we still have a tremendous relationship. I'm an investor in his company. And there were, you know, many others at all levels of the organization along the way. And my most, you know, grateful moment, as well as emotionally toughest moment, was when I left Greenpoint. I started getting all these emails from the employees, and at first I read them and I deleted them. And then I started saving them, and I must have had 1,000, 1,500 emails from employees saying how much we're going to miss you and how we like the fact that you reached out and touched us. And I said, isn't it amazing? Because earlier in my life, I would have never thought of it. But now, the only value, the only skill that I ever want to aspire to is being the person who has the key that can turn somebody on.
Yes, that's so good. Talk to those that are coming up and they are coming into the industry for the first time. What would be your advice to a new millennial getting a job in this business, just coming out of college? What would you say, do the following things and you'll be successful in the mortgage industry?
See, I love your question, but one of the things I'd like to say is the future is always different from the past, and
they're going
to have to make a path their own. And I can only speculate on what's going to be needed to succeed in the future as opposed to the past. So I'll say, learn about all aspects of the business and how they connect together, and learn about other companies that are doing things differently and newer technologies and newer trends and how you can leverage them to take things further. And be very open-minded and not shy about giving others credit and learning from them. Because ultimately, if you want to be a leader, you want to be an orchestra leader. And an orchestra leader isn't necessarily the best at every instrument.
That's right.
They just can produce wonderful music.
Yes.
And so, but they have these people who are geniuses at a particular instrument.
Yeah, that's so true.
So
I love that.
Don't try to beat them. Because early on, you come out of business school or you come out of school and you join a company and you say, I've got to be the best at everything. And you'll drive yourself crazy. You don't have to be the best at everything. You've got to be the people who's best at leveraging the efforts of people from different sides who are the best at what they do.
Find the people that are the best at what they do, help them be successful, and you'll rise up.
And connect them together and create music as opposed to Discord.
And that's a really interesting point, because a lot of people can find and identify intelligent people. What has been your key to getting the teams to work together?
A lot of time spent with them, a lot of time, and sometimes through the frustration of boards or people I worked for when I had bosses refusing to significantly differentiate between the performance of them. So one time, you know, like Teresa gained a lot of market share. So when we did a performance evaluation, I equally rewarded my CFO for that success. And so boards do their job. They have to make sure shareholders' money is being spent wisely. And they said, why are you rewarding your CFO for marketing success? I said, because we couldn't find capital, and the CFO was creative in finding the capital that allowed Teresa to write the business.
That's really
without
good.
It, we would not have been able to. Likewise, my CIO, I said, the business volume was growing so fast that if we hadn't been able to
create right.
that. So people forget that you don't win in an organization by just one part of the organization excelling. Success comes from everybody contributing to that common goal. And you have to make very, very sure you don't drive any wedge between them by saying, you're more important than the others. So everybody in the organization, I used to tell my financial people, and the reason Radiant survived is because they were so creative in creating internal capital when we could not access external capital. So you are equally responsible to make sure that this company is successful. And if you have a happy customer, you equally deserve the credit
right.
because you do other things that make it happen, likewise in HR, likewise in every part of the organization.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell me about this, the future of the industry. Where do you see the future going?
I continue to feel bullish about the industry. What has frustrated me is we are a latecomer for understandable reasons
right.
because we've had this reliance on a secondary market, regulations that make the mortgage process very difficult. But I would like to see a future where somebody can see a home and in 3-4 days
own the home
and move into it. So it's not impossible. There's a lot of barriers to doing that, and it's not going to happen overnight. But when I first got into consumer lending in the credit card business, if you wanted to get a credit card, you had to go and pick up one of these applications that they used to call take ones, and you had them
yep.
everywhere, stores and everywhere. And you had to fill out this application, and you sent it in, and you'd get to send proof of employment and your bank records and your W-2. And then, you know, 6 weeks later, you got a measly $1,000 credit line. And later on, I mean, when did you hear of anybody applying for a credit card? You get delusional for offers.
Yeah, that's right.
And the industry hasn't broken down. If anything,
no,
the market
grown.
Cap of those companies is much greater. They've been far more successful. So that's my thing. You know, focus on the customers and making things easier from them and how you can remove barriers. And don't focus on very narrowly on the bottom line. Focus on the fact that your responsibility to the shareholders is to increase the market value of your company and not necessarily in the near term maximize the bottom line. That doesn't mean you ignore the bottom line
right.
or achieve decent profits, but don't go for the last penny at the expense of the future.
That's a great point. S.A., thanks so much for taking a few minutes sitting down here with me. This has been excellent. I love the wisdom.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for being such a great thought leader in the industry and bringing your own insights and sharing the insights of other people like me and giving us the opportunity to share our thoughts.
That's what I'm doing. I'm following your footsteps of, you know, taking the knowledge of others and putting it out for others to benefit and grow from. Thank you so much, A. Richie, so much.
Thanks for listening to Licking on Leadership, a weekly podcast about leaders in the mortgage industry. Tune in next week, and thanks for listening.